G'day folks, I am coming to you today from a different room in the house. I thought I'd mix it up a little bit, in part because there are some people out there blasting like palm tree roots out of the ground as well. My office sits right above it. So you might even get a little bit of background noise from that. I think I mentioned it 2-3 weeks ago, something like that. We're doing a bunch of renovations, which includes like ripping the entire garden out and just replanting basically everything, except for the palm trees that are sort of the size that those of you watching the video can see behind us. Turns out those bastards have got massive roots, and the massive roots have like gone through the drain, and then the stormwater drains aren't working, and we do get some pretty torrential downpours here. So this is sort of the fun of doing like anything renovation wise. You peel back one layer and then there's something under there, and you peel back another layer and there's something under there. So what started out as a garden has now got like a bunch of tiles and hoses and pipes and things being replaced, which is, I don't know, it's like, I guess that's just what happens when you renovate. It's the first time I've ever done any renovations, so now we're kind of learning about that. Be that as it may, I did come to a nice cozy room in the house. This is almost summer here in Australia. And again, as many of you know, I live on the Gold Coast, which is sort of the summery part of the sunny country. So it's 300 days of sunshine a year here, which is part of the reason why I don't like going away as much anymore. And that pool looks really inviting at the moment, as does the water. So there might be a jet ski on the horizon yet. Yeah, fun times. So moving on, a couple of blog posts this week. And in fact, before I do the blog post, one thing that kind of popped up in my Twitter feed this morning, which I just sort of thought deserves a recap. So this was about a motherboard article about biometrics and effectively saying that researchers had discovered that using artificial intelligence, however they did it, computer simulations and systems and things, they'd managed to find sort of a set of master key fingerprints, if you like, that could unlock certain devices. And I always find this interesting because the headlines are prone to imply, if not say, that biometrics are unsafe because some really skilled researchers have managed to do something pretty sophisticated. And I think it's worthwhile just touching on this again because I put out a few tweets to this effect, and I sort of said, look, number one, this is cool, right? Like, let's get our geek on. This is like cool research that they've been able to figure out how to create like master keys for fingerprints, all right? Cool without any caveats. And then the thing is you got to say, okay, well, what are the conditions required in which to create this particular exploit, for want of a better term? Got to have smart researchers, number one. Access to things like artificial intelligence or whatever other machine. Oh boy, just had a plug fall off. So I've like MacGyvered up a portable light, which is sitting here and it's plugged and everything's kind of precarious because this is not set up for this. So excuse the bangs. And the tree blasting just stopped as well. So make it a bit nicer. Anyway, so they've got to have dedicated researchers, experts in their field, create sophisticated things. And if that is the threat that you were worried about, then maybe you shouldn't be using biometrics. And then I'm sort of saying, look, for everyone else, it's like, who are you worried about? You're worried about the person who steals your phone off a bar, someone who pickpockets it out of your bag. I'm worried about my kids, you know, like these are the threat actors for normal everyday people. So, you know, that is one thing that I think is very important. And this is not just a biometrics discussion either, right? This extends through to everything else, including the things we're going to talk about later on with 2FA. Being conscious of what are the risks for each choice of security decision. And I guess as part of that, acknowledging that none of them are ever going to be perfect. They have different risks, they have different complexities, they have different costs, they have different impacts if they go wrong. So that was sort of part of it. And then I kind of said, look, if your threat actor, for want of a better term, is, let's say, a nation state who has the levels of sophistication in order to be able to do this, then maybe biometrics aren't a very good thing for you. Also, you're probably going to want to do a bunch of other things very differently to what normal mere mortals would. And I kind of wrapped it up by saying, look, this is, as I said, super cool research. This is great because it makes it better for everyone. You know, like maybe there'll be a few more people now who go, well, because of my particular risk factors, I'm not going to use biometrics at all. for the most of us, it has absolutely zero impact. And what will happen is later on, whatever devices it is still using touch, my outgoing iPad, I've got the new one coming, which is only going to be Face ID, those devices will get better. So, you know, like let's just keep a little bit of perspective on this and do a little bit less losing of minds. Now, moving on to something different. Content security policies. Now, this is a blog post I wrote a few days ago, and I'll give you a little bit of context here. So, content security policies, or CSPs, do many wonderful things for websites, including the ability to whitelist allowable sources for different content types. So you can build a website and say, anyone who comes to this website, their browser can load fonts from these locations and scripts from those locations. And what I mean by locations is one location would be self, your own website. Another location would be Cloudflare CDN, for example. So Have I Been Pwned loads jQuery off Cloudflare's CDN. So my CSP has to say, Cloudflare is allowed to serve this JavaScript to this website. And if, for example, someone finds an XSS attack or something else nasty that they want to try and exploit on Have I Been Pwned, they try and load script from evilcyberhacker.com. I actually own that domain, by the way. If they try and load it from there, the content security policy will block it because it's not a whitelisted source. So these are cool. Now, one of the things that we can do with a content security policy is we can report on violations. So let's take the evil cyber hacker thing. If someone goes to Have I Been Pwned, they manage to get a script onto Have I Been Pwned from evilcyberhacker.com, my content security policy is going to raise a violation and it's going to report to a URI of my choosing. Now you can actually see this in action. So you can go to Have I Been Pwned, go to one of the images on the page, and change the source just in the DevTools, right? So in the DevTools, go and change the source attribute of the image to somewhere else. Now, an image off your own website, or an image off Google Images or something like that. And then watch the console and you'll see a red error, which will be a violation, and watch the network tools and you will see that violation report sent off to a website called report-uri.com, which is the service that Scott Helm and I run. Now, we run that service in order to take content security policy violations, among other types of reports. We also do HPKP and a few other things, but predominantly CSP violations. So we run that service, people report to Report URI, and we get about 10 billion reports a month at the moment from different websites, all submitting violation reports to us. And then the owners of those websites use our Report URI service to go through and filter and do nice graphs and things like that. Now, that's the background. One of the things that we have always known about and we've always seen is extensions, as we'd call them on Chrome, or add-ons as we'd call them in Firefox, causing CSP violations. So for example, if there was an extension that tried to insert an image into every single page that you visited whilst you were using Chrome, and that image was loaded from mylegitimatesite.com, but that wasn't whitelisted, then that would cause a content security violation on a website like Have I Been Pwned. So everyone who goes to Have I Been Pwned with this extension installed, the extension's trying to insert an image, is going to be sending security violation reports back to Report URI. Now, why would an extension try and insert an image? Well, maybe that's the function of the extension. So for example, maybe it inserts a little image which is some sort of indicator of the ability to translate. So perhaps the purpose of the extension is to provide translations. So you get like a little, let's say it's a little speech bubble, for example, that's an image, you click on the image and then it will translate your website. For argument's sake, that would be a valid use case for an extension, a legitimate extension, and it would cause a content security policy violation on my website. Now, we know about this, we see this in the logs all the time. And Scott and I have had many discussions about how do we deal with this? Do we filter out the noise? Because it is noise. It is not a problem with the website. It is a problem with the extension. And I'll come back and explain why that's a problem. So do we just filter it out of Report URI? That would be one option. Or do we go back to the extension maker and say, you shouldn't do it this way? Now, I'm going to explain how they should do it in a moment. But we decided to do the latter. And we decided to do the latter with a service called Honey. Now, this is Honey on Twitter, so probably pretty valuable Twitter handle right there. And I had seen requests for cdn.honey.io in my content security policy reports for months, I've seen it over and over and over again, constantly trying to inject fonts into the page. And at first I was like, oh, that's just another extension. And then I was seeing it a lot. And then I'd run workshops and things like this. And other people would go, yeah, look, we keep saying honey as well. And I was like, well, what is this honey thing? Is this a safe for work thing? Because it's kind of got a bit of an edgy title. Anywho, turns out that Honey is a service that's used by about 9 million people that allows you to get discounts when you go and shop on a website. And the way it works is you've got this extension running in your browser. You're on Amazon or whatever other website it is. The extension's able to see the site you're on, and then it's able to go, hey, honey, do you have any discounts or coupons or vouchers or whatever it is for this website? If so, then let's apply them and people save money. So I totally get the value proposition of this. Everyone likes to save money. Good idea to save money. So what I decided to do is get in touch with Honey. So I reached out earlier on in this week and said, hey, has anyone got a security contact in Honey? I got a lot of replies. A lot of people jumped to the wrong conclusion, which is the nature of me asking for a security contact these days. But I did get a contact very quickly, and they were awesome. So the folks at Honey were sensational. So they replied very, very quickly. They understood exactly what the problem was when I said, hey guys, look, here is what Honey is doing. And what I really wanted to do was say to them, there is a way to do this better. And it's not just Honey, this is every extension or add-on developer. And the way to do it better is that an extension or an add-on should be whitelisting itself if a content security policy is present. So for example, if the Honey extension wants to insert fonts into a page and it sees that there's a content security policy on the page, it should, within the font source directive, add cdn.honey.io as an allowable source. So effectively what they're doing is saying there's a CSP already, that's cool. We're just going to make sure that we don't violate it because we are going to do something that the operator of the website wasn't necessarily expecting. You know, we're not going to be whitelisted. Now also about this point, a lot of people go, hang on a second, like extensions can screw with CSPs. Like I've got a content security policy on my website to protect people and you're saying an extension can come along and just rewrite it. Extensions can do just about anything, and I've made this point many times before that you put a lot of trust in the extensions that you run. And I normally make this point after an extension has gone rogue. So for example, someone's built an extension, it's got 70,000 installs around the world, it does something pretty benign. Someone comes along and says, hey, how would you like $10,000 for your extension? They sell the extension, and now the extension's mining Bitcoin, serving malware, doing whatever else, because this is what an extension can do. It's got a lot more power in your browser than what a website does. So I kind of make this point in the blog post. And incidentally, the title of this blog post is Add-ons, Extensions, and CSP Violations, Playing Nice with Content Security Policies. So extensions have enormous power. And in fact, in here, I go through and I install the Honey extension. And I've got a screen cap, so when I install it in Firefox, in which case it's an add-on, not an extension, it says, add Honey. So this is Firefox. Firefox is saying, add Honey, it requires your permission to access your data for all websites. Now, one would imagine that all websites includes your social media and your bank and maybe other sorts of websites that you visit that you might not like to talk about here. So the point I'm making is you give extensions a huge amount of control and you really only want to use the ones that you trust. Even trust is a difficult word in this situation. That you believe are going to be less likely to being bought by someone for 10 grand and turned into a rogue extension. So the point is that is how we would like extensions to behave. We would like extensions to whitelist themselves in the CSP if a CSP is present. And I'd encourage anyone who is using Report URI or if you're using CSPs and reporting somewhere else, if you see extensions not playing nice, contact the developer, point them to this post. Like, let's get extensions to clean up their act, because the more noise we take out of content security policy reports, the more effective they are, because we can focus on the legitimate stuff and not the screwy stuff. Now, as it turns out with Honey, Honey did not mean to put the fonts into the extension and have them load into the DOM. They actually fixed that in Chrome some time ago. And I did find it interesting that it was only happening in Firefox, but I'm sure that I'd seen it in Chrome before. Report URI puts a little logo of the browser vendor next to the report. So I was just seeing like Firefox all the way down. And they were actually already in the process of taking it out of Firefox of their own free volition anyway. And apparently that the process for submitting it to Mozilla was just taking a bit longer than what the process for Chrome was. So that's going to be fixed. Anyone using content security policies with reports are going to see honey drop out of that. And that's how to fix these violations as an extension developer or an add-on developer. Okay, cool. So that was that one. Now, on to something else. And this one, if I'm honest, I've not even read all the comments on this yet because I posted it last night. I was just super, super tired because of a very long day the day before that I might touch on later on. And I haven't read the comments. I glanced at them. They were nice comments, good comments. Now, here's the blog post. Beyond passwords, 2FA, U2F, and Google Advanced Protection. So what I wanted to do is try and, in part, change the tone from last week, because last week was a little bit depressing. Last week was a combination of passwords are not going to go anywhere. This is last week's blog post. Passwords are not going to go anywhere because even though they suck, everyone understands them and they have very, very low friction, and this is the thing that's going to keep them here for the foreseeable future. And people got a bit upset about that because they're like, well, it shouldn't be that way. Well, it is that way. You know, what are you going to do about it? And then the next blog post was the one that a lot more people got upset about, which was the one about the fact that users are partly to blame if they use bad passwords and then they have an account takeover. And people got upset for all sorts of reasons. And I went into that in a lot more detail in my weekly update last week. And I did actually watch that one back again. I rarely watch these back just because I don't have the time. But I watched that one and I was very happy with the way I explained it. And I think that that is probably why I didn't get negative feedback from the video. So hopefully people are aware of the sentiment there now. We all have a role to play in our security. We get to make decisions about what we do that makes us safer or less safe. One of those decisions is around 2FA. Now, there was an impetus for going down the path I've gone down and then writing this. And the impetus was a relative of mine lost access to their Google account. And they used Gmail, so that was obviously pretty serious. And on the surface of it, it didn't look good. So they got in touch with me because I'm tech support guy, as many of you probably are for your families. And they said, look, it's asking me for my password. The password doesn't work. The website is coming back and telling me. So apparently Google will actually tell you if you're trying to use a previous password. And they say, look, your password was changed. And on the surface of it, it didn't look real good because they're trying to log into Google. Google's saying this password was correct, but it's no longer correct because it's been changed. And they're going, well, I didn't change it. And your first sort of reaction in a case like this, when it's Google and when it's a case where the password has been changed and the user's not sure that they did it, you kind of go, okay, well, you know, someone's gotten access to their account. And the only thing that sort of stopped me from thinking that was the case was that they do have 2FA enabled. Now, some people are already going to get upset because it's 2FA via SMS, and they're going to argue that it's not 2FA if it's SMS, yada, yada, yada. We'll come back to that. But the point is that they had a second step of verification there. So this would have then required not only knowing the user's password, but then being able to get that verification token, which is sent via SMS. So I'm thinking, well, you know, that's possible. You can still phish that. You can create a phishing page that asks for the username and password and then says, okay, now, plug that into Google, SMS goes, let me now take the, I'll add another field, I'll say please enter the SMS you just sent. A lot of things have got to line up, okay? This is not necessarily a trivial thing, and not least of which, the time of it's got to line up, because these are time-limited one-time passwords that you'll send via SMS as well, TOTPs. So I thought, yeah, no, it's possible, but not particularly likely. The other possibility, and this is probably more the Occam's razor under these circumstances, is that they changed the password and just didn't realize it. And it did turn out to be the latter, and I'm still not entirely sure how they managed to change their password without realizing it, but this is what happened. So I put out a tweet, this is going back a couple of weeks now, asking for a contact at Google to help me do account recovery because their recovery email address was an old email address there they didn't have access to anymore either. Even though they still had access to the phone and they could receive messages there, that wasn't sufficient to convince Google that they were legit. So I reached out to Google, got some help, managed to get the account recovered, everything set back up. As part of this process, I started having a bit of a read, because it was presented to me on various screens, about Google's Advanced Protection Program. And their Advanced Protection Program is effectively using UTF, which is physical security keys. Now, I'm going to talk about Advanced Protection in just a moment, but I think it's worthwhile just recapping on the different mechanisms of 2FA or other FA or other acronyms, just to be clear about this. And what I have seen, I've read all my Twitters since yesterday, is people have really, really loved reading this, because apparently it explains it in a way that's pretty consumable. So I want to sort of relay some of it here, because it's important. When we say 2FA, we mean two-factor. And in fact, I'm going to rephrase it, because I don't even necessarily know that we always mean that. Strictly speaking, by definition, 2FA is two-factor. Something you have, which would be something like a physical token, something you know, which is normally your password, something you are, which goes back to biometrics, fingerprints, face, etc. So yeah, it'd be two of those things. So most typically when we talk about 2FA, it's going to be something like, okay, you've got to enter a password, which is the bit that you know, and then you've got to receive an SMS to the phone, which is the thing that you have. Don't get upset yet, I'm going to come back to this. You'll see why I say this. And people would consider that 2FA, because now it's these, you know, these two things. The challenge with this is that 2FA is not always literally by strict definition 2FA. And you'll see the words 2FA or the acronym 2FA used very frequently in places where, probably strictly speaking, it's not really. The SMS thing. You don't necessarily have to have the phone to be able to do SMS recovery. And here's what I mean by this. What happens if your SIM is hijacked? So we're seeing a bunch of SIM porting attacks lately. And the SIM porting attacks are really problematic, because what happens there is someone manages to get messages destined for your phone number sent to somewhere else. You don't physically have the phone, yet someone passes the second factor. As I say in the blog post, it almost gets a little bit semantic in terms of defining what is 2FA and what is not 2FA. And I'd rather talk about the actual technical implications and the risks and the processes you go through. So I'll give you a really good example of this. Very often, instead of 2FA, we would say two-step. Good example of two-step is you have to enter one password, it gets you through the first gate, and then you enter a second password, gets you through the second gate. That is absolutely positively one factor. They're both things that you know, but it is two steps that you have to go through. And depending on how you manage those two passwords, it should be stronger than just having the one password. If we think about something like the SMS example, and we might sort of now get down to the implementations of different means of two-step, 2FA, whatever the hell we want to call it. The problem with SMS is, first of all, the SIM porting situation, which is very, very worrying. If we go beyond SMS and we start saying, okay, what is our hierarchy of auth? Imagine this. So we got passwords alone, 1FA. We've got passwords and SMS, quasi 2FA. Yeah, and normally you have to have the phone, but someone else could port your SIM, etc. Let's be clear. The SMS thing, if you need a password and an SMS, that is still better than just needing a password. And I want to sort of harp on this a little bit, because often I hear people say 2FA, or whatever you want to call it, via SMS is worse than just a password. But it's not. It's not. You can't have a password plus something else being worse than just a password. It is stronger to some extent. And then there's an argument about what extent that is, but it is always stronger. I think the thing that people get upset about, and you really want to check this with your accounts, there's not like a hidden agenda behind this, but this is something that you really seriously want to check. The problem is if you can do account recovery with just the one factor, which is SMS, because then if someone manages to hijack your SIM and port it to somewhere else, and they manage to get whatever recovery code it is sent to that SIM, now you've got a problem. So this is where people get upset, and they're right to get upset about that, but when it is used in a true two-step implementation where you need the password first, it is always better than just the password alone. So there's a hierarchy. Passwords, SMS. We go on to soft tokens. Some of you may use Authy. I certainly use Authy. Some of you may use 1Password. You can also put your tokens in there. I certainly use 1Password. Some of you use Google Authenticator app. That's another one that I seem to end up using everything for different cases. But these are all soft tokens in that it is software that runs normally on your phone and it generates a token, and then there's a little countdown thing. A little countdown thing gets down to zero and then it generates another token. So those are time-limited one-time passwords. And hopefully that term makes complete sense. You've only got until the counter counts down. I think there's a little bit of a buffer normally. And you can only use them once. You can't come back and use the same one again. Now my wife is coming home. She's going to wonder why I'm sitting here in the kitchen table, all done up like this. So they're two different models. It's noisy out there, so I'm recording here. Okay, thank you. All right, so two different models. So we've got passwords and soft tokens. Now, the thing with the soft tokens is they're very, very easily accessible. So you can go and install Authy, and you can configure that in minutes, and it's on your phone. You can synchronize it to your other devices. We'll come back to that because there are potential problems there. And from an accessibility perspective, they work really well. You don't have to be connected to a carrier for it to work. You don't have the problem of SIM porting. There's an edge case. We'll come back to that as well. But for the most part, it works very, very easily in a very low-cost fashion and in a very consumer-friendly fashion. Now, where we can sometimes have problems, and certainly this has been the case with people that don't configure Authy in the most optimal way, is when there is the facility to synchronize between devices, and you can synchronize by initiating an account login via things like SMS. Well, now you've kind of got a problem, because what happens if someone else gets access to all your tokens? Well, they're soft tokens. They exist on the device. There are people that certainly argue that soft tokens are not two-factor, because even though you have to have a device with it running on it, access to the token can be granted by something that you know, which might just be the pass. You see where I'm going? So it's not quite the same as you absolutely positively have some sort of device in your hand. So that said, I do want to reiterate that point. Soft tokens like Authy and 1Password, which has the soft token built in as well as all the password manager stuff, are the best implementations that we have in terms of that balance of cost and usability and security. And I'm quite happy to stand by that. So moving on, hard tokens. So I used to have one of those RSA secure ID tokens when I was back in corporate land. So that would be a token which is, I guess, like half the size of a credit card, has a battery, literally has numbers on it. Counter goes down, numbers cycle. It is a physical representation of a soft token. We had them long before we tended to have soft tokens on devices. You have to have that present. You cannot replicate that in the same way that you can replicate a soft token. So you would have to have it on your keyring. I mean, I think I used to keep mine in the bag that I'd put my laptop. So that is an improvement, but of course, now you've got the hardware cost problem. So you've got to go and buy these things. And if you're let's say you're an organization with 100 people in there, you've got to go and buy 100 of these tokens. You've got to ship them out to everyone, and then they expire eventually as well. I remember I used to rotate them. I originally had one of the little sort of rectangle black ones, and then I had the gray one with the arm and the circle bit at the end. So yeah, these things do actually need to incur some cost. And of course they have the usability impact. And they've just started blasting palm trees again out there. Now the other thing is, people always find a way to screw up security. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. I'm looking at one of the pictures in this blog post, and it's a webcam pointing at an RSA token. And the really funny thing about it is someone has actually written an entire blog post about not only how to set it up with the webcam pointing at the RSA token, but also how to OCR the numbers on the RSA token afterwards. So they have like jerry-rigged a physical representation of 2FA into something which now becomes 1FA, because inevitably all they need to know is the password for the website which has the streaming webcam on it. Or I don't know, maybe they are even just emailing the token. It's who knows, but it obviously completely undoes the very premise of having 2FA. So that brings us through to the fifth level in the hierarchy of Auth, which is U2F. Now, many people will be familiar with terms like YubiKey. So YubiKey is a massively popular implementation of U2F. And U2F is just universal two-factor. It is actually a standard. It's owned by the FIDO Alliance. It's nice to have standards for these things, because then you can be consistent across browsers and clients and various implementations of it. And something like a YubiKey generally is just like a key that looks like a little USB stick. Or it doesn't necessarily have to be a USB stick, because I can't stick a USB stick into this phone. It could be NFC, it could be Bluetooth. So the joy of these devices is that they need to be present with you when you authenticate to a service which requires a security key using UTF. So security key is sort of the colloquial term that we use. And what it means is that, let's say for Google, and I'll talk about the enrollment process in a moment, but let's say for Google, if I want to log into my Google account, not only do I need to have my username and my password, it's still the same strong password that's in 1Password, I've got no idea what it is, it's just crazy. I've got to have that, and then it will say, now insert your security key. And I have to either take the USB one and stick it into my laptop, or take the Bluetooth one and hold it near my phone, and then either way, press the button on them to go, yep, I want to log in. So you have to have it present. These can't be phished. There are no numbers to read. The only way I'm ever going to be able to log onto my Google account is I've got to have that key with me. If I don't have it with me, I'm kind of screwed. So I have to either wait until I get home and I get my key if I've gone out and I didn't have the key with me, or I have to go through what looks like a very unpleasant recovery process. So that's sort of the value proposition. In terms of Google's implementation of their Advanced Protection Program, you've got to have two keys. Now I have a feeling that their guidance changed between the point where I ordered the keys and then when I wrote the blog post. But they recommend that you have two keys, which in my case, which needs to work with iThings and also my PC. They're recommending a Phetian bundle. Now Phetian is a Chinese manufacturer of security keys. Within this bundle, it's a two-in-one bundle, there's a multi-pass, which is a white sort of teardrop looking device, probably a little bit bigger than my thumb. And there is also a black unit which just plugs straight into USB and does also have NFC. I neglected to mention that in the blog post, even though the picture literally says NFC. So they're two different keys. Now you have to go through this enrollment process where both keys are enrolled on the Google account. This gives you some redundancy. If you lose one key, you can fall back to the other one. Now, as an example, I will keep that white key with me. I've already literally cable tied it into my bag that I always travel with. So I never travel anywhere. This is when I go on planes. Never travel anywhere without that bag. It will always be there. And by using the Bluetooth one, it means I can authenticate to my phone, or I can plug in a micro USB cable and authenticate back via USB into my laptop. The other key I'm going to put in a safe in a geographically remote location, which is where I put other secure backups and things like that as well. So I'm going to have somewhere, should the whole house burn down, where I can go and I can get that key and I can log back in again. That is a very effective way of doing auth. It means that I have redundancy with the two keys. It means that the thing can't be phished. It's the best possible implementation we have in any sort of mainstream consumer-facing mechanism today of doing 2FA with UTF. There are other providers that do UTF as well. And just looking quickly at my list, the immediate ones I found that seemed relevant, at least to my audience, were things like Dropbox, Twitter, Facebook, GitHub. None of them, in fairness, are as slick as Google's. Like the Google implementation is just so nice. You've got to go through this. It's super cool. So go and have a look at the Google implementation. Conspicuous by its absence is Microsoft. And I have made that point to Microsoft as well. I said, look, I've just gone through the Google process. It's super awesome. Microsoft should be in there. In fairness as well, Google only introduced this, I believe, last year. So someone can tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's only last year. This is much, much more recent than I guess what many people believe. We've had UTF and we've had FIDO Alliance and things for much longer than that, but to make it in a mainstream consumer accessible fashion, this is the trick. And it kind of goes back to the blog post from last week about why passwords aren't dying. It's because they are easy. And unless we make alternate authentication mechanisms easy, they're just not going to get traction. So I'm super happy about that. YubiKey, let me mention the YubiKey very briefly, because the YubiKey thing is something that people raised as well. YubiKey is an implementation of UTF, and it is a very, very good one. They have well and truly cornered the market in terms of brand recognition I dare say most of the UTF keys out there these days are probably YubiKeys. They've got everything from Bluetooth ones to NFC ones to USB ones to USB-C ones. A few people said, look, I've got the new MacBook Air, it's only got USB-C. Well, there's a USB-C, what are they? YubiKey. And were I to do this again, I probably would get the current gen YubiKey, which has every protocol I need built into it. It's got NFC, so it will work with this, and it's got a USB, so it will actually work with my PC as well. And I'd probably go down that path. And the main reason that I went with the Feitian stuff is that I wanted to like literally follow Google's instructions, like a normal everyday consumer, write it up, target it at that audience, and sort of look at it and go, is this mainstream ready? And look, honestly, the answer is yes, I think anyone could sit down and do this. I also bought a bundle for my wife, so I'm actually gonna say to her, look, just follow the instructions. You know, like I don't wanna do this for you. Follow the instructions. Tell me how you found this experience. But you know, she's probably more tech savvy than most as well, so maybe not entirely representative. But as much as it is consumer friendly, this is not the password killer. And it's not the password killer, first of all, because you gotta pay $40 for the bundle. Like imagine this, for most people out there, you're sort of saying, this will improve your security. All you gotta do is pay $40. If you lose them, you're screwed. You won't be able to log back in again. Account recovery will be hard. You've always gotta have them with you. A hacker might get your things. Look, what are they gonna do? So unfortunately, I think people are still going to use this at a very, very low adoption rate. But I'm hoping the sorts of people that watch me and the things that I do are the sorts of people that are gonna be much more likely to adopt it. And hopefully even evangelicalize it a little bit to everyone else, including Microsoft and the other organizations we'd like to see support it. All right, so that is it for today. Last up is NetSparker sponsoring my blog post again this week. And as I've said many times before, I've done things with NetSparker for probably about the last 7 years now, mostly using their product back in corporate land. And now I use it when I do demos in my workshops as well. So big thanks for NetSparker for being there as a sponsor again. I have actually just sold out all my sponsorship through to the end of July next year, which again, probably demonstrates that I'm still not very good at pricing it and positioning it, but it does mean that I'm full of sponsors, but I am keeping a short list of organizations that want to hear about what opens up after that. And I'm going to continue to refine that process and hopefully make it the best possible model. Until next week, thank you very much for watching, and I'll probably be back upstairs somewhere quieter then. And as for now, I think I'm going to go back out there to the pool. Thanks, guys.